This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Earlier this month, the government suddenly announced the impending death of NHS England, the overarching controlling body set up by the coalition government, remember them, over a decade ago. At the same time, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who on taking office declared the NHS to be broken, is preparing his promised 10-year plan for the health service, which will be published in the summer. There's a lot going on. So how does this reorganisation fit into the bigger picture of improving the health of the whole nation, not just England, and doing it in a way that's affordable? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is NHS England? Why is it being abolished? And what has the government said about its health priorities? Hugh Pym is the BBC's health editor. Hugh Pym, what is the reorganisation the government has announced?
Well, it's a very big move in terms of health policy. It doesn't necessarily affect services on the ground, hospitals, GP practices, community health and so on. It's all about the central organisation of the NHS in England. Now, there's an organisation called NHS England, which is the central body running NHS policy throughout England, which is at arm's length from the government. And what Keir Starmer and Wes Streeting are saying is they think that is an unnecessary construct, being separate from government and autonomous, and that it's duplicating work going on at the Department of Health and Social Care, and that it should be basically swallowed up by the department, and there could be a total of around 9,000 jobs lost. So essentially, you won't see a separately branded, distinct organisation called NHS England, certainly within about 2 years' time when these changes go through.
Right. Why was NHS England set up in the first place and who set it up and what happened since then?
Well, it goes back to 2013 when the Conservative Lib Dem coalition was in power and the reforms under Andrew Lansley, which became notorious for shaking up several ways of organising the NHS in England, proved in some cases to have not worked out at all well and to have been very expensive. That set up NHS England as an arm's length body separate from government. Now, the idea was to keep politicians away from sort of interfering too much with the running of the NHS. And what preceded it was a setup which had persisted for really decades, where the organisation of the NHS was within the department and reporting directly to the Secretary of State. So the logic was keep politicians away, let experts run the NHS. But of course, that resulted in a series of tussles with Secretaries of State feeling they had to stand up in the House of Commons and defend the health service and policy, but didn't feel able to say, well, that's an arm's length body. That's really up to them.
A totally predictable situation, you'd have thought.
Well, you'd have thought so. I mean, the argument has raged in recent weeks with these changes being announced. Was it ever going to work to try to have experts and health managers running NHS England without very much interference from government? That being said, Amanda Pritchard, the outgoing CEO, chief executive of NHS England, said that since she came on board in 2019 as number two She'd served under six separate secretaries of state, including Matt Hancock, Sajid Javid, Steve Barclay, and so on. So there was the logic to having continuity at the top of the NHS when ministers changed pretty frequently.
Very interesting. Now, what's the situation, Hugh, in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland? Do they have an NHS England equivalent, or are they actually closer to the ministers in those places?
They've stuck with the more traditional model, which did continue in England up until 2013. So in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, essentially the NHS is part of the health departments and very much with ministers in control of policy and senior managers reporting direct to them. And that's, in essence, the direction of travel now in England, to go back to that sort of model. Now, time will tell whether actually it's a better model or not, and patients will be entitled to say, will any of this help me get a GP appointment more rapidly? I think it's hard to say at this stage. The other bit of logic for the change that ministers have been talking about is saving money, that they want to reallocate money from these central administrative roles out to the front line to hospitals and other parts of the NHS. How quickly will that happen? They say they can save maybe up to £500 million a year. How quickly will that really filter down through regional organisations and out to the front line? A very big question there.
Do you get a sense of what was their primary objective? In other words, saving money versus closer control?
Well, I think there has been a frustration in recent years that NHS England is duplicating what's going on at the department, and it's resulted in more targets and more paperwork for clinicians, and they've been frustrated about that. There's a certain logic to have a greater simplicity of command, if you like, or leadership, so everyone knows where they stand. But the buck does stop now with Wes Streeting, very much the Secretary of State. And as Richard Meddings, the outgoing chair of NHS England, said in a BBC interview, it wouldn't be possible anymore to point the finger at another organisation and say it's their fault. And he also made the case for having experts coming in to run quangos, as they've been known, arm's length bodies, because they do add something that MPs and professional politicians don't have.
Now, Hugh, in addition to the abolition of NHS England, the government is due to publish its 10-year plan. When do you anticipate that happening, and what do you think might be in it?
It's due in the summer, so the government has already set out three key objectives for health policy in England: to shift more resources from hospitals into community health, to make better use of technology for the benefit of patients, and to be better at prevention of ill health. Now, I think those will be running right through this 10-year plan, but it's fine to talk about it. Successive politicians, ministers and health leaders have talked about this sort of thing for a while, but actually shifting resources to allow patients to be treated more in their local communities, it's all very well talking about it. How do you actually deliver it? And of course, hospitals remain under great pressure at the moment, with A&E as a sort of fallback, maybe, for weaknesses in community care and social care. And of course, social care is the other huge element here. It's not going to be part of this NHS 10-year plan. But as we know, it's a longer process with a different commission looking at the future there. And many people have said, and on many occasions, if you don't sort social care, it's very hard to have a sensible plan for the NHS.
Hugh Pym. And before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about our overcrowded prisons and the one about spiralling costs in special educational needs.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, back to the NHS. What do the experts make of the abolition of NHS England? And, big picture, where do they think the government should go next? I'm joined by Siva Anandasiva, who's Director of Policy at the King's Fund, Dr. Jennifer Dixon, Chief Executive of the Health Foundation, and Carol Proper, Professor of Economics at Imperial College London in the Department of Economics of Public Policy. First, since you're all three of you experts, I'd just like to ask your reactions to the announcement that NHS England is being abolished. Jennifer Dixon, were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised that NHS England might be pruned back, but I was surprised at this sort of shock announcement. And my immediate response was pretty much the same as Brenda from Bristol, which was not again, because we've seen a lot of this over the last 10, 15 years. It's colossally costly, it's distracting, all the things that we will go on and talk about. And I suppose the question, the big question for me is, why do we keep doing this? And why do we not prune and adapt as we go along so we don't have to have these big chainsaw lurches?
Siva, did you have any notion that this might happen, any kind of suspicion?
In all honesty, no. So I was absolutely floored by the announcement. I suppose on different levels. So am I surprised that NHS England as a national body is being folded back into the Department of Health and Social Care? Probably not. That's the least surprising bit. But I'm surprised that they've decided to do it in this way by doing a formal merger rather than working closely together. I'm surprised at the scale of the cuts that are on the table. You know, Wes Streeting was clear he wants a smaller centre of government running the NHS, but I wasn't expecting 50% of cuts.
Carol, what about you?
Similarly, I was surprised and disappointed, like Jennifer, in the sense that these reorganisations are very costly and distract from the real task of delivering healthcare in an environment that's tough. One thing I will say, though, that I think is in favour of pruning is that I think all government departments get something called mission creep. So once they're in place, they tend to take on more and more functions and do more and more policy areas that they weren't initially tasked with. And I think that was a reason that NHS England was duplicating in some places with the Department of Health and Social Care.
What would be an example of that?
Well, I think it's a bit unclear who's responsible for policy around GPs in the current structure. And family doctors have reflected on this, that their wage bargaining, as it were, is first with NHS England, but then it needs to be ratified by a minister, and that's the Department of Health and Social Care.
Siva, how much money is getting rid of NHS England expected to save?
We've heard estimates of £200 to £500 million a year. Unclear whether that includes all the payouts that will need to be made if you're going to make people redundant. Now, £500 million is a lot of money, but just to put it into context, we spend nearly £200 billion on our health service. And NHS frontline services are facing a funding gap of about £7 billion. It's an awful lot of reform for a relatively small saving, if that's why you're doing it.
Carol, there seem to be two arguments being made in favour of the abolition. One is cost and duplication, essentially. Let's imagine they're the same thing. And the other one is accountability, that you should be able to say straight away, because it's actually true, that in fact, it's always going to be the Secretary of State who calls the shots.
I think when NHS England was set up and when these kind of spate of quangos were set up, there was a thought that the quango could do delivery and the centre could do policy, and it would have the impact of that everything that went wrong in the NHS wouldn't end up on the Secretary of State's desk. But actually, in practice, that's not what happens at all. It still ends up on the Secretary of State's desk, and there are plenty of levers that the Secretary of State can pull to make NHS England do what he or she wants it to do.
From what everything that all three of you have said, you've not suggested that it would make any significant difference in itself to health outcomes in the UK. It's a small means towards an end. Can we look at that, those bigger challenges? Because going on at exactly the same time, as we've heard from Hugh Pym, the government's preparing its 10-year plan, going to come sometime in the summer, supposedly. It concentrated on three areas: hospital to community, in other words, getting people out of hospitals and dealing with them in the community, much better use of technology, better preventative care. And I want to go into all those areas with you in a moment. But Jennifer, can I just check in with you where we are on the issues that always get the most attention in the here and now? Elective waiting lists, same-day access to GPs, A&E waiting times. What's happening about those at the moment?
Well, the short answer is the waiting lists are coming down, but probably more slowly than the politicians would like. Still over 7 million people waiting, still a few people waiting over a year, but definitely going in the right direction. Same-day access to primary care is slightly better than it was pre-pandemic, actually. And over half of people get to be seen within 48 hours. A lot of people seeing the GP of their choice, or at least the continuity. So things improving there as well. The issue is emergency care, where I think there's less progress. I would say there has been progress and then there's going backwards during the winter. So I think the jury is out on that one. But generally, the dials are going in the right direction. The issue is here the impatience, the need to see them done more quickly, not least thinking about the political, you know, 3 years, 2 years to show an impact.
Siva.
I'm still surprised at how much we have normalised levels of performance in waiting times that I think would have just been absolute anathema 20 years ago. You know, 60% of people are being seen within 18 weeks when the target is 92%. So these, again, are levels that we just want to accept, but we've normalised them. The second thing, though, is I think it's really hard to, you know, understand what does a body like NHS England actually do? Well, part of what it does is share good practice. So if you've got really good, high-performing A&E departments, can you understand what really makes them tick and share it with poorer-performing departments? That is one function that, at the moment, is being thrown up in the air due to these restructures and reforms.
Carol, what I wanted to ask you was, aren't these things that we measure, particularly these three, aren't they symptoms rather than causes of poor healthcare?
Yes, they're the kind of outcomes that emerge when you have poor healthcare. Clearly, waiting lists are coming down, but A&Es are still full of elderly, frail people. And I will say that NHS productivity is still pretty low. It's still estimated to be about 20% below its pre-pandemic peak.
Is there any clear one-sentence phrase that can tell us what productivity in the NHS actually is?
It's basically a measure of activity. Not a measure of the health gain, but it's a measure of the activity that the NHS does divided by the number of staff.
I mean, because the reform to NHS England or the abolition of NHS England is what prompted this programme, and because the 10-year plan is for England, Siva, I also want to ask you whether the big challenges facing healthcare are the same, pretty much the same in the other nations of the United Kingdom as they are in England.
Yeah, I think there are some subtle differences. So, for example, when I look at waiting times in a country like Northern Ireland, there are long waits for care, waits for over a year for care, that are far, far higher than we have here in England. And there's certain issues with access to rural services in Wales. But fundamentally, if you look at rising demand for healthcare, ageing and iller populations, pressure on services, long waiting times, financial distress in service providers, wherever you live in the UK, you are feeling that pain, you are experiencing that pain.
And before we also dig into those three priorities in the 10-year plan that was set out, Jennifer, we also need to add in social care, which I think is not going to be dealt with in that plan.
No, social care, exactly. Social care is being dealt with through a commission, which will report in a couple of years' time, 2028, I think it is, by Dame Louise Casey. There's meant to be phase one and two. The phase two solution, which everyone is focused on, will be in 3 years' time. However, if you look at A&Es and you go and walk around them, you will see that most of the people in A&E will be older, and indeed, certainly on the wards, that's the case, and are unable, as we all know, to get out of hospital and live independently. So social care is a very, very massive issue.
Let's look at the three elements which the government identified in the 10-year plan: hospital to community, preventative health care, and tech. Jennifer Dixon, can you explain why technological change and embracing technological change is so important for the health service?
Technology is really the biggest hope here. And the reason why it is because of the costs of care are largely centred on staff. There is at the same time a global health worker shortage, and we have a demographic challenge. We have fewer and fewer workers coming into the workforce. So really the great hope here is to try to stabilise the costs of care, given this huge wave of morbidity that's coming at us through demographic change, 80% of it coming through the ageing of the population as the baby boomers age. So that means we need labour-saving technologies, we need productivity-enhancing technologies. There is nothing else that can produce the kinds of step change in trends that we need as that. And therefore, all the hunt is on for this type of technology. And then the other reason, of course, is to try to enhance independent living and health, earlier diagnostic, earlier treatment, prevention, just as the Secretary of State says. But all of that is going to cost. The other thing I would just add here is that in pursuing a policy towards greater technology, life sciences, there's two almost could be slightly opposing objectives here. One is to sustain the NHS as a model, keep it offering high quality care into the future. The other is to grow GDP, sell the stuff abroad. And the stuff that sells abroad might not be the stuff that is high priority to sustain the NHS or indeed social
care. Such as?
Well, it could be that you want the latest possible treatment for a rare disease that costs a huge amount, transforms the lives of people with a particular disease, wonderful, but it actually could bankrupt part of the NHS. But it's saleable to the United States. So this is where you need leaders on the sustainability of the NHS side, as well as leaders on the life science side that can come together and thrash out what might be the overlap.
Carol.
Clearly, you know, as an economist, the way you increase your productivity per worker is to invest in more capital. That technology includes things like more scanners, more MRI machines, because they simply can, in the end, kind of substitute for people. But one of the things that I think is something that, you know, we could do really quickly, but just don't seem to be able to do, is really get electronic patient records sorted out in the UK. And that in the short term would help an awful lot, having patients having to tell different providers things time after time. And many hospitals have made those investments in these kind of systems. The problem is that it often doesn't join up at local level with GPs. And that would be one quick push that doesn't require masses of investment. I mean, it's not costless, but would really improve things because you wouldn't have failures in diagnosis. You wouldn't have failures in, for example, things like prescribing, and that medical errors are costly.
Siva.
I've become a real fan of boring technology. You know, it does things like I'm a GP and suddenly I've got an AI-supported program that transcribes clinical notes really well. And it's just ambient in the room, so I can focus on the patient in front of me rather than facing my computer. Like Carol said, electronic patient records, which mean that when you transfer ward or turn up to a new setting, you're not a surprise to the health service. And it's for staff as well. The simple stuff that means you don't have to sign into 17 different computer systems and turn up half an hour early for your shift.
I want to turn now to, Carol, to hospital to community, trying to keep people out of hospital by emphasising community health. What needs to be done there broadly?
The rationale for this is it's much cheaper to treat people either before they become very ill or to treat them in a community setting, if that's at all possible. And the NHS has been trying to do this for some time, but not always with that much success. Now, the NHS has been trying to do things like virtual wards, which is basically discharging individuals to their homes, but using a mixture of technology and visiting staff in some cases to try and deliver care outside the hospital setting.
Jennifer.
I mean, if you look back over the funding of the National Health Service over the last 20, 30 years, what you find is the lion's share of growth has gone into hospitals and not in community services or primary care. So I think you see a lot of areas run down, not least even the public health grant, which has declined by 25% since 2015. So that needs to be boosted.
Can you just give me briefly an example of what in the public health sphere has been run down? What actual services or people?
All the things that public health would be funding, such as drug, alcohol, smoking, those sorts of things, some early years services as well. So all of those things need to be tackled.
Siva.
Yeah, this is one area where I can definitely see the sunlit uplands. You know, I could imagine in 5 to 10 years' time, I'll be popping down to my high street into a community diagnostic centre to get a scan rather than trying to completely rejig my day to get to a hospital. So I can definitely see how more treatment in the community could happen. And, you know, I think the government's being pretty courageous in focusing on this. The bit where I think we have to get real is part of the deal is poor hospital care in the interim. You know, I think you can absolutely look at improving hospital services through better productivity. But if you've got an extra pound, are we really prepared to invest it in a community service when the cost is maybe a longer wait?
Let's move on, Carol, to preventative healthcare. This can seem very vague. I mean, at one level, it can seem just like if everybody just eats properly, if everybody just takes exercise, we'll all be more healthy and bish, bash, bosh, problem solved. The difficulty has always been, as any GP will tell you, is getting people to do any of those things. Well, that's one of the problems. Are there any new ideas in how to assist preventative healthcare become better?
Obviously, preventative healthcare involves things that aren't health care in a sense. They're to do with, as you say, diet, exercise, the environment people live in, because that's really what drives their health. One of the ideas that's been around in this area is really to change the prices of food. So at the moment, we have essentially a soda tax, a sugar tax in Britain, but no real other taxes on food that try to encourage healthy eating. The idea would be to try and put a bigger range of what you can think of as bad foods, ultra-processed foods, and other cheap foods that last a long time that don't have much nutrition, put a higher tax on them, making them more expensive, and possibly using some of the money from that to subsidise things like the consumption of fruit and fresh vegetables.
Jennifer, one of the programmes we did recently was about semaglutide treatments for obesity. And the essential problem we came across was that effective though these treatments undoubtedly are, we can't afford to prescribe them at the moment. And you can't help thinking that if you really wanted to solve a problem way down the line, you'd find a way of funding something like that, despite its high cost.
Well, I think at the heart of all of this is how much responsibility and how much focus do you put on the individual, give them anti-obesity drugs if that's what they would like, or how much do you put an onus on the state to, for example, stop the pollutants into food, which are addictive and sort of encouraging them to eat more. The needle has just been shifted far too more towards the individual as opposed to the role of state. But to be honest, to tackle obesity, we have to go there on the nanny state stuff. So although we may be able to afford a certain amount of semaglutide, really we have to devote ourselves to the other part of the telescope to start talking about how do we change the choice environment by through actions of the state, through taxes, through better labelling, through regulation, quite frankly.
Siva, one of the objectives, I imagine, of the government is not just better health outcomes, but also to stop us having continuously to spend a higher and higher and higher proportion of GDP on health at the expense of everything else. Might these things that we've been talking about lead to controlling costs in the long run? In other words, could we imagine that if we did these things, it would actually be less expensive to get a good health outcome?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, part of the rationale for doing all this stuff focused on prevention is better healthcare, living longer with a healthier life. But part of it is controlling costs, because on our current path, it's simply not sustainable in multiple ways. You know, there won't be enough land in England to build all the hospitals we need for all the people who are going to need hospital care. So that's part of why I think the government is so focused on this treatment to prevention angle.
Carol, you're the health economist. Can you envisage this cheaper health service, but with a better outcome?
I don't think it'll ever be cheaper. What we're trying to control here is the rate of growth of costs. You know, the holy grail here is to try and stabilize that at some level that's acceptable to the population and is acceptable to the kind of tax base that you have.
We're coming towards the end. I just want to ask Jennifer whether the political timetable for any government, this is a 10-year plan which is supposed to be forthcoming, that has to presume that the government that supports it survives the next election into the next one. And you wonder whether the political timetable, you've got to show all these waiting times ticking down, is at odds with any long-term reforms timetable.
Well, it's totally at odds. You know, the political timetable has got to be 2 to 3 years, hasn't it, to show results for the voters and in very tangible ways of the ways that we've been discussing. But actually, to sustain a health system into the long term, you need to build longer term stuff, including the data systems, the buildings, the kit, training people, not least with this huge opportunity ahead of artificial intelligence. How are we going to adapt the workforce to that over time. The question is, are the arguments and evidence strong enough going into the future that unless we deal with some of these medium long-term issues, we are not going to have a National Health Service as we know it?
And that's all we have time for. My thanks to Jennifer Dixon, Carol Proper and Siva Anandasiva. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Beth Ashmead Latham, Kirsty Knight and Caroline Bailey. The sound engineer was James Beard. The editor is Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again really soon.
It's a parent's nightmare.
So I said, oh, it's a boy. And I was holding my hands out, ready to cuddle him, and they took him away.
A switch at birth, discovered with the gift of a home DNA test.
The so-called brother that we grew up with wasn't a brother, and there's someone out there, if he's still alive, is.
A race against time.
I don't want this woman to leave this earth not knowing what happened to her son.
The Gift from Radio 4, with me, Jenny Kleeman. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.